Okay, so to get started, so recall that we found before that the scale factor can grow exponentially in time when the equation of state parameter is close to minus one. Okay, right. Yeah, so at times when w is close to minus one, you can get a growing exponentially as a function of time. And so back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, Alan Guth realized that that a phase of this sort of exponential expansion back in the early universe could actually resolve several prominent problems for standard cosmology. So let's just briefly talk about some of the famous classical problems solved by inflation. So first is what's called the horizon problem. Okay, so just the basic issue here just is that different patches on the observed CMB that are on like opposite parts of the sky, those different patches are causally disconnected according to the standard lambda CDM cosmology. And therefore, so since they have never been in causal contact, it's surprising that their temperatures are the same to like 1 part in 10 to the 5. Just to remind you, okay, so the causal horizon is just the co-moving distance that you can travel since the start of the universe. And the distance to the CMB last scattering surface is very similar to the horizon distance, just because the CMB last scattering redshift is so high. So if we draw, let's say, like the last scattering surface of the CMB, centered on us, the horizon centered on us is at a very similar distance. Okay. Anyway, yeah, so the point is that, yeah, so patches, let's say over here and over here on the CMB, so clearly they are separated by more than a horizon distance even today. And therefore then it's like really surprising that, that their temperatures are basically identical. What's even worse though, is that at the time of CMB last scattering, the horizon back then, the horizon size back then was much smaller than it is today. Okay, so it's not only surprising that these patches on opposite parts of the sky have the same temperature, but also patches that are separated by more than the horizon distance at that time, they're also the same temperature. Okay, and so all this is just, very puzzling. Okay, so since we'll need this later, let me just remind you the expression for the co-moving horizon distance. Okay, so I'll call that r horizon. And it's just an integral over conformal time, d eta, which is integral over dt over a. This is the integral of dA over a times dA dt, which is a dot. Okay, and this is the integral of dA, and then a dot is a times h, so a squared h. Okay, and so for the horizon, this goes from start of the universe until today. Okay, so generically, you can see that this will scale something like some number divided by a times h. Okay, for example, okay, during radiation domination, which is how the universe mostly was expanding prior to recombination, so during radiation domination, the dominant energy density was radiation, which scales like a to the minus 4. Okay, Hubble by the Friedmann equation scales like square root of rho, so therefore scales like a to the minus 2. And so therefore this 1 over ah, prior to, I mean, so during the time of during the time of radiation domination, therefore scales like proportional to a. Okay, and so if we plot this as a function of time, okay, so we plot this 1 over ah compared to the scale factor, this just grows linearly. Okay, so today, so the horizon size for comparison is some huge size. Okay, today, but back during recombination, when a was much smaller, the horizon size was, back then much, much smaller. Okay, so anyway, yeah, that's right. So again, just the basic question then is, so for patches that, so for patches of this size, so much smaller than this size, why is the temperature so uniform? Okay, Good, so that's the horizon problem. The next classical problem solved by inflation is this old flatness problem. Okay, so the flatness problem is very easy to state. Okay, so as we said before, observationally, the universe is observed to be very close to spatially flat. Okay, and so the flatness problem is to explain why that is the case. So for example, today we know that the omega curvature today is much, much smaller than omega matter today. Okay, in the past, we know that curvature only decreases. So in the past, so if we plot this as a function of time, the curvature scales like 1 over a squared. The matter scales like 1 over a cubed. Okay, today we know that the curvature is tiny compared to matter. Okay, so in the past, it was even tinier compared to matter. Okay, so the puzzle is, why back in these initial times was the curvature so tiny compared to any other scale in the problem? Okay.
Why is it a problem? Like, it's just like the extrinsic integer of anything that like we're working with. Why? I mean, like it can be zero. Like.
Oh yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah. So one possible solution would be some sort of like symmetry principle setting the spatial curvature to zero. But there's no such symmetry principle that we know of. And so the puzzle, so the puzzle is that, so for some generic random initial condition back at very early times, you might think that the curvature contribution would be similar to everything else. But clearly it's not, because because back then, if it were similar, say, to the matter or the radiation density, then by today it would have dominated over all of them, right? Okay, so the puzzle is to explain how come back then it was so tiny compared to any kind of like relevant scale in the problem. Okay, good.
The solution should be some symmetry argument that like the universe is so symmetric that it's flat. We would go on. But.
You could work hard on trying to find some symmetry principle. However, though, we're going to see that inflation solves this problem for us without invoking some sort of new symmetry of the universe. Okay, good. So that's easy to write down. And then the third problem is the so-called monopole problem. Okay, so this is a more theoretical problem. And this has to do with so-called grand unified theories. Okay, and so the context here just is that, so we believe that, so all these standard model gauge interactions will be unified at high energies under some larger symmetry group than the SU2 cross U1. Across SU3 symmetry groups, in some unknown larger symmetry group. So at low energies, like today, the idea is that this larger symmetry is broken spontaneously. And the problem, that arises is that, as we said before, back at very early redshifts, back at high temperatures, the horizon size back then was tiny. So the reason why that's a problem is that for regions which are causally disconnected back then, there's no reason for this spontaneous symmetry breaking to happen the same, the same way for all these causally disconnected regions. That is, there's no reason for the vacuum to settle into the same ground state over here and over here. Okay, does that make sense? You're making faces. So one famous example, of course, is the famous like sombrero potential, okay, right? So you can have, this part of the universe over here falling into this vacuum state, over here, for example, can settle into this vacuum state, and so on and so on. Okay, so for causally disconnected regions, there's no reason for them to all fall into the exact same ground state. So why is that a problem? So the problem is that today, regions which back then were causally disconnected, today are, today, those regions occur within our horizon and therefore are observable. Okay, so today we see, around us in our, so in our universe, many, many independent regions which originally were causally disconnected and therefore which originally should have been in different vacuum ground states. Okay, so why is that a problem? The problem is that if you have two different regions that have settled, so if you have two different regions that have settled into different vacuum states, the boundary between them generically will be unable to settle into the ground state. Okay, so these regions that are unable to reach the ground state, they're called topological defects. Okay, the exact same as the topological defects that can arise in crystalline structures, right? Okay, so at these boundaries, you'll have, you know, regions where the vacuum is not in the ground state and therefore has a huge vacuum energy density, okay, and therefore would be like really, really noticeable in the universe, okay? Right, so the number of these topological defects, generically works out to be of order, of order one or so per horizon volume, okay, at the time of this symmetry breaking. We observe many, many such volumes inside of our universe today, so therefore we should have today many, many of these really massive topological defects, which are not seen observationally.
How could we observe them if they were there?
Okay, good. So one really easy way to observe them is just gravitationally, okay? So the vacuum energy density will be of order like the gut scale, the fourth, okay? Which would be like an enormous gravitational mass today. We would see the gravitational effects of these defects on the, you know, on the motions of the photons, baryons, galaxies, etc. Right. Okay. Yeah. You know. So from the lack of these sort of gravitational imprints, we know that there are not large numbers of these gut scale defects.
How can we say that we're not seeing these gravitational imprints? Because like we don't know the distribution of these topological defects. So like it can be anywhere. It can be dark matter. You know. I mean, like, we can see this gravitational interaction, like, in terms of anything. We don't know what is the distribution. What should we expect?
Oh, no, we do. Okay, good. So, all right. So, when you guys do your tutorial, you're going to work out the evolution of perturbations, okay? One of the key arguments that was used to show that these sort of defects like cosmic strings are not a dominant source of energy, is that they source perturbations continuously as a function of time, okay? So instead, inflation, we're gonna see like this week, inflation generates initial perturbations, okay? Those perturbations then launch like sound waves, which we then see as the baryon acoustic oscillations, which are in phase, okay? If we instead were continuously generating gravitational perturbations, at all times, okay, that would wipe out the coherence of the baryon acoustic oscillations in the CMB, okay. And so instead of getting these acoustic oscillations in the CMB, okay, so instead the predictions of models that produce structure using cosmic strings were instead something without these coherent oscillations.
Have these coherent oscillations at the time of, this is for the time of recombination.
But observed at the time of recombination, okay.
Yeah.
Exactly, okay. So what I'm saying is that prior to recombination, if there were enormous defects, like cosmic strings monopoles, moving through the universe, okay, they would be continuously generating, disturbing the motions of baryons and photons and dark matter as a function of time. And the effect of this is to erase these coherent oscillations in the CMB, instead of just making this, a very smooth power spectrum.
Just to make sure that I'm understanding, you're saying that the order of magnitude of the number density of these topological defects at the time of before recombination was one. And the number
one, like of order one at the time of the early horizon at the time of the gut scale, which is of course much smaller than the horizon size at the time of today, but also at the time of recombination.
So what we expect this topological defects effect to be larger now rather than at the time of?
Larger now, sorry.
Because the number density of these topological defects is larger because we have like more patches that were before causally separated.
There could be many, many of these patches, that's right. That's right. And so therefore many of these topological defects could survive until today. That's right.
And the effect should be large now, not on the BAO that's coming from recombination.
Oh, I mean, there would be effects today, but also there would be also observable effects even at the time of recombination.
I see. Okay, so you're saying that even that observable effect is large enough to look at the traces on the baryon acoustic oscillation. We don't need to just search for
That's right. So the strongest bound, I think, on these defects actually comes from the CMB, right? From the lack of any kind of okay, so we haven't talked about adiabatic perturbations yet, but you guys will do that, in your tutorial. So from the lack of adiabatic perturbations, from the lack of any deviation from adiabatic perturbations, we can constrain you know, the presence of anything like these massive topological defects. Okay, sorry. Yeah, you've been asking the question for a while.
You kind of mentioned it briefly, but yeah. So I was wondering, like, I've heard of cosmic strings. So are these just cosmic strings? And when you say we don't observe this at all, aren't some people still studying like cosmic strings and looking for cosmic string signatures, maybe in CMB or elsewhere?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so these sort of gut scale cosmic strings are excluded. But in string theory, you can also produce things which are analogous to these cosmic strings. People are observationally looking for signatures of these more like, you know, superstring associated cosmic string.
Yeah. So would that be like something other than, I don't know, like something that's not the Higgs, but something else that's not in its ground state or something? Like a different particle that's not in the standard model?
Well, I think they said that the string theory people says there's this there is just this one string and it got a really, really big.
Oh, so it's not the same idea as this?
It's like a string.
But one more example, I think, you know, would be things like, you know, axion fields,
right.
you know, similar to like the moduli fields present in string theory. So in the same way that you can have, you know, topological defects in, let's say, you know, okay, well, right, so this is like the Higgs, but okay, but anyway, right, like, you know, I mean, okay, like, you know, so in the same way that you can have, you know, defects in this field, also in the axion field, you can have similar topological defects, which would then, you know, look like these sort of cosmic strings. But again, their energy density, I mean, the energy scale isn't anywhere near the gut scale. It's something much smaller.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Right, good. Okay, anyway, yeah, okay, so good. So, right, so there are all these so-called problems for the standard lambda CDM cosmology, and inflation can resolve all these problems. Okay, so yeah, so what people realized back in the 70s and 80s was that an extended period of this sort of exponential expansion can explain all of these so-called problems. Okay. So first of all, obviously, if we expand the volume of the universe exponentially, we can exponentially dilute the abundance of these sort of topological defects, okay, thereby resolving this monopole problem. We can also resolve this flatness problem similarly. So if we grow the scale factor exponentially, we can make the 1 over a squared contribution from the curvature, again, also exponentially small. And then inflation also solves this horizon problem. Okay, so if we go back to our expression for this horizon distance, this integral, okay, so for normal cosmologies, this result, this integral is dominated by the endpoint, okay, so it's dominated by like, 1 over a h, at the time a when you're observing, okay. Inflation breaks that, okay. So if we have this sort of exponential expansion, okay, with a constant Hubble expansion rate, okay, so you can see then that if h is constant and this 1 over ah doesn't grow like a, but instead scales like 1 over a, okay? So what that means really, just is that 1 over ah at the time when you observe isn't the actual horizon, okay? The actual horizon is this integral, which will be dominated not by 1 over ah at the endpoint, but instead by the starting point, okay? And so again, if we let a grow exponentially large as a function of time, then this, okay, right, then the starting point will be exponentially tiny, making this 1 over a therefore exponentially large, okay? So the actual horizon is therefore much, much, much bigger than this 1 over ah at the end of inflation. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so yeah, so since we mentioned last week that this scale 1 over ah is important for the, for the evolution of perturbations, let's just plot this quantity 1 over ah, as a function of time. Okay, so before we said, so for standard cosmology, this is the behavior, okay? If we instead inflate, if we plot this 1 over ah as a function of time, okay, you can see that it decreases like 1 over a, okay, while we're inflating, And then at the end of inflation, say we then enter like a radiation dominated era, then it'll grow again as a function of time. Okay? So the behavior that we'll see later on is then, so now if we compare this to some, to some perturbation mode of some length scale, okay? So a length scale can first become smaller than this, larger than this apparent horizon, okay? And then eventually then become back in the apparent horizon at late times, okay? And then similarly for these other smaller scale modes, okay? And so next time we're going to see that, the perturbation modes generated by inflation, the earliest ones to exit the horizon will also be the last ones to re-enter the horizon later on. Okay, yeah. And so tomorrow we'll talk about that. Okay, anyway though, yeah, so right. So again though, the way that inflation solves this horizon problem is to make the actual horizon, basically as large as you want. Okay. All you need just is to make this exponential phase last for a long enough amount of time. Okay, good. So the next question then to ask is then, how much inflation do we need to solve all these problems? Okay, yeah, so how much inflation? And that's pretty easy to answer. Okay, so for example, so today, as we said before, the observed CMB looks fairly uniform. Okay, so for inflation to explain the horizon problem, so what's needed is for the observed horizon size today to be causally connected prior to inflation, right? Okay, so today this size, distance to the last scattering surface, as we said, is of order like 10 gigaparsecs. Okay. And so we need this scale to be inside the horizon during inflation. Okay. Now to solve the monopole problem, we also want inflation to happen, to happen after this gut, a symmetry breaking scale. So let's say that the gut scale is somewhere around, 10 to the 15 GeV. Okay. So inflation therefore would have to happen after this. Okay, good. So now what we'll do now is to figure out the horizon size is 1/ah at this temperature. Okay, so the argument is like very simple. Okay, so all you do, is to take this temperature and then work out the energy density rho just by using that rho is something like, G star times T to the fourth, okay, for this temperature. Okay, then you just use the Friedmann equation to get h in terms of rho, okay? So h is like 8 pi g rho over 3, which is like, rho over 3 Planck mass squared. Okay, so that's h. We want ah. Okay, so to get a, so again, all you do, is to figure out this scale factor that, at this time, just by using conservation of entropy as we did before. Okay, so before we said that g star a cubed t cubed is constant. Okay, so if we know t, and we know g star at that time compared to today, that then tells us the scale factor a that we need. Okay, and so putting that all together, so what you find is that ah, at this temperature is about 27 orders of magnitude smaller than this size. Okay, so therefore we need at least 10 to the 27. In this expansion of the scale factor, which corresponds to about 60 e-folds of inflation. Okay, so the answer is that we need n around 60 e-folds of inflation. Okay, to solve both the monopole problem and also the CMB horizon problem. Okay, and of course this also then solves the monopole problem. Because it dilutes the abundance of these monopoles. By this 10 to the 27 cubed. Yeah, you had a question?
What do we mean by this statement? Like, n is about 60 e-folds?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm just saying that 10 to the 27 is around e to the 60.
Yeah, okay.
That's all I mean, yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay, good. So good. So yeah, so then for inflation to solve all these classical problems, that's how much we need. Okay, so then let's then talk about how can we get that much inflation. Okay, so since we only have another like half an hour, let me just very briefly tell you about the very simplest way to produce this much inflation, which is called slow roll single field inflation. Okay. So scalar field inflation. Okay, so the argument is as follows. Okay, so let's consider some scalar field phi. Okay, and suppose that this phi has some Lagrangian density, you know, with some standard, you know, with some standard kinetic term and some potential. Okay, so I'll write this as d phi squared for the kinetic term, and then some potential via phi. Okay. We can derive the stress energy tensor, you know, associated with this scalar field, okay, just by, you know, just by taking the variation of the action with respect to the metric tensor in the usual way. And so what you can show is that T mu nu has the following form, d mu phi minus L. Okay. And then from the stress energy tensor, we can then work out things like the energy density, the pressure associated with this scalar field. Okay, so what you get is that rho is 1 half phi dot squared plus 1 half grad phi squared plus via phi. And then similarly, the pressure is 1 half phi dot squared minus 1/6 grad phi squared minus via phi. Okay, so right, so again, so dot here, the over dot just means time derivative, and these and these derivatives are you know are proper physical derivatives. Okay. So let's change from these proper physical derivatives to co-moving coordinates. Okay, so all that does is to bring down two factors of A. Okay, so now these are co-moving spatial derivatives. Okay, now again, so our goal is to produce inflation, you know, in which this scale factor A grows by some, you know, by some exponentially large factor. Okay, and so therefore, for a model of inflation that's successful, these terms will become tiny compared to the other terms, okay? And so therefore, now what I'll do is to neglect these spatial derivative terms compared to compared to the potential and the time derivative terms, okay? So later on, we will come back to these spatial derivative terms because they will be crucial when we discuss the perturbations generated by inflation. But for now, let's just talk about just the smooth, unperturbed universe during inflation, okay? And so if we neglect these terms, the energy density is approximately 1 half phi dot squared plus V, and the pressure is approximately 1 half phi dot squared minus V. Okay, now as we said before, to get inflation, we need the overall equation of states parameter of the universe to be close to minus 1, which means pressure close to minus rho. Okay, and so you can see that to get that, we need the potential to be much larger than this kinetic term. Okay, so does everyone see that? Okay, good. Right, so therefore what we need is 1 half phi dot squared, much, much smaller than this potential term. Okay, right. So our goal, therefore, is to make this phi dot for the scalar field very small, which is why this is called slow roll. Okay, so then how do we make this phi dot very small? Okay, so we can figure that out just by writing down the equation of motion for this scalar field. Now, the usual way to derive the equation of motion for the scalar field, you know, just as to vary the action with respect to the field and its derivatives. A simpler way, though, since we already have expressions for the pressure and the density just is to write down, the continuity equation for the energy density. Okay, so if you recall, rho dot plus three H rho plus P is equal to zero. Okay, so then if we now plug in our expressions for rho and for P, okay, we can derive the following simple equation of motion for the scalar field. So phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v prime of phi equals 0, where now here prime means the derivative with respect to the field value. Okay, so the usual intuitive way to think about this equation of motion is to make an analogy, to something like a simple, analogy to something like a ball rolling down a potential. Okay. Right. Okay. So think of the field value as this like ball rolling down this slope. Okay. So the acceleration of the field value, the acceleration of this ball, you can see that it has two terms. Okay. First is the slope of the potential that is rolling down. And then secondly, there's this this friction term, right? This term, so this term you can see generates an acceleration that opposes the motion of phi. Okay, so to get inflation, we want slow roll. That is, we want a small phi dot, okay? And so clearly, intuitively, so getting a small phi dot requires having a small v prime, a small slope, okay, in some sense, okay? And so in what sense do we mean that? Okay, so we can make that statement more precise using the following argument. So let's start with the Friedmann equation, okay? So h squared is 8 pi g rho, which is 8 pi g phi dot squared. Okay, if we take the time derivative of both sides, we get 2h h dot is equal to 8 pi g over 3 phi double dot plus v prime times phi dot. Okay, and now using our equation of motion, we can eliminate this phi double dot term, okay? So you can see that phi double dot plus v prime, which appears here, okay, that's just minus 3h phi dot. Okay, so then let me replace that with minus 3h phi dot. Okay, so then this boils down to minus 8 pi g h phi dot squared, okay? Good. So this equals 2h h dot. Okay, so then let me just divide both sides by 2h. So 8, well, all right, I'll just write it out again. Okay, so therefore h dot is therefore equal to minus 4 pi g phi dot squared. Okay, good. Now our slow roll condition was this, that phi dot squared is very small compared to v. Right? So if we take this expression and then multiply both sides by 8 pi g, okay, and we get 4 pi g phi dot squared is much, much less than 8 pi g v, which is like 8 pi g rho, which is there, which is therefore like h squared, right? Okay, so therefore, was that too fast or?
Wait, why is v related to rho like that?
Okay, so we have slow roll. So this is small compared to this. And rho is 1 half phi dot squared plus v. So therefore, v is basically like rho.
Oh, I see. Right.
Okay. Good. So therefore, our slow roll condition, therefore, then boils down to that h dot, okay, in magnitude is very small compared to h squared from the Friedmann equation. Oh, you can't see, huh? Did that help or not? Okay. Okay, right, so I can rewrite this inequality as d by dt of 1 over h is very small compared to 1. Okay? So this 1 over h is like the e-folding time of the scale factor. Okay? So the statement that d by dt of the of the inflationary time scale being small compared to 1, okay, that just means that the rate of change of the Hubble expansion rate is slow compared to h. Okay? So then let's define these the slow roll parameter epsilon. Okay? So we'll define it as this h dot compared to h squared, okay, you know, which again is, yeah, you know, d by dt of 1 over h. Okay, so therefore, for inflation to happen, what we need is that this epsilon is very small compared to 1, okay, which again just says that the Hubble expansion rate doesn't change quickly as a function of time. It's also easy to show using the Friedmann equations that this epsilon is also, this epsilon is simply related to the overall equation of state of the universe. I will leave the derivation to you. It's like a two-line derivation. So you can show that this epsilon is just 3/2 of 1 plus w. Okay? And so our statement, that epsilon is small compared to 1 is just the statement that w has to be close to minus 1. Okay? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I have two questions. The first one is, so if we're looking at, say, this for inflation, are there any known fields, say, in the standard model or related to the standard model that could stand in for this inflaton?
Okay, good. So what are the scalar fields in the standard model? Okay, good. So the only possible standard model field that can drive inflation is the Higgs field, and so there are models for Higgs inflation. But besides the standard models, also plenty of BSM models for inflation.
Is the potential for the Higgs field, like, do we know what that would look like, and would that be big enough?
Yeah. Right. So okay. Good. Actually, good. So yeah. Bear that thought in mind. We're going to talk about whether or not, from some like random potential, depending on where you start, can you actually get enough inflation? Okay, good. Yeah. So if we get to there in the next 10 minutes, yeah, then we'll do that. Then we'll do that calculation. Okay. Anyway. Okay. Good. So right. Okay. So yes, yeah, so we have this slow roll condition. The next thing now I want to do is to relate this epsilon to the shape of this potential V. Okay. Good. So let's start with. Let me get some room. Okay. So let's start with our slow roll expression that I'll just rewrite. Okay, so it was phi dot squared over 2 is very small compared to v of phi. Okay, so now to get enough inflation, enough e folds, so we want this condition to hold for a long amount of time. Okay, so to see whether this is true for a long amount of time, let's take the time derivative of this expression. Okay, so the time derivative then gives us phi double dot phi dot. Is much, much less than v prime times phi dot, right? Which therefore implies that we need that phi double dot is much, much smaller than v prime. Okay? The equation of motion for phi that we derive somewhere here, okay? The equation of motion is, yeah, phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v prime is equal to 0. Okay, so our slow roll condition tells us that this term is tiny compared to this term. Okay, so therefore, the slow roll condition plus our equation of motion tells us that this term and this term must be about equal to each other in magnitude. Okay, they must. Yeah, I mean, right. So this term and this term, so they must sum to almost zero. Okay, Right, so therefore we have that 3H phi dot, okay, is approximately equal to minus V prime, and that, okay. And then similarly, phi double dot must be very tiny compared to V prime, and also very tiny compared to 3H phi dot. Okay, in magnitude, yeah. Okay, so this left-hand side, this is the rate of change of phi dot. So we're saying that the rate of change is phi dot, the rate of change of phi dot is very small compared to phi dot times the Hubble expansion rate, okay? So therefore, this being tiny compared to this says that phi dot doesn't change much over a Hubble expansion time, i.e. that, you know, slow roll is maintained, okay? Good, so now let's use this expression here that 3H phi dot is about equal to minus V prime. Okay, so then this then tells us that phi dot squared is approximately equal to V prime over 3H squared. And before we had derived that phi dot squared is H dot over minus 4 pi G. Okay, so this is also equal to minus h dot over 4 pi g. And of course, epsilon we had defined as minus h dot over h squared. Okay, so then setting these two equal to each other, okay, we can see then that phi dot squared is so we can show that epsilon h squared over 4 pi g, okay, is approximately equal to v prime over 3h squared. Okay, so then, okay, good. So now we can, now solve for epsilon in terms of v prime, okay? And so we get that epsilon is approximately 4 pi g times V prime over 3H squared, quantity squared. Now we can use the Friedman equation, okay? So Friedman equation tells us that 3H squared is 8 pi G rho, which is 8 pi G V, okay? So therefore this works out to 1 over 16 pi G of V prime over V squared. And now let me now replace 8 pi g with the Planck mass. Okay, so this is the same as saying that epsilon is 1/2 times Planck mass v prime over v squared. Okay, and so for slow roll, we need this to be very small compared to 1. Okay, and so what this says is that our potential V governing the scalar field, okay, its slope has to be small in Planck units, okay, to produce inflation. Okay, good. So this is the first slow roll condition. Now we can also derive a second slow roll condition. Okay, let me write that here. Okay, so suppose that we also want this condition that we wrote down before, 3H phi dot, okay, approximately equal to minus V. Okay, suppose that we also want this, this expression, you know, to also hold for, you know, for a long amount of time. Okay, so that'll then clearly give us, you know, one more condition on the shape of the potential. Okay, so we can go through the exact same line of reasoning that we used here. Okay, you know, so we can take a time derivative of this expression. Okay, and so on and so on. You know, so I'll skip the derivation. Okay, so what we can show, you know, is that the second condition boils down to setting V double prime much less than V in Planck units. Okay, and so then conventionally, what we do is to define a second slow roll parameter, unfortunately called eta, as M Planck squared V double prime over V. Okay. And so for this to hold for a long amount of time, we want eta to be very small in magnitude compared to one. Okay. Okay, so again, I want to stress that this eta, this has nothing to do with the with the conformal time eta we said before. Okay, so unfortunately, you know, Dolson used eta as the conformal time. So in his book, he defines this slow roll parameter, you know, not as eta but as delta. But no one else uses that notation, okay? So therefore, I'll just stick to normal notation, okay? You know, so, okay, right, you know. And so conventionally, the second slow roll parameter is called eta. So hopefully from context, it'll be clearer which of these etas I'm talking about in various contexts, okay? Good, so, okay, so, right, so therefore, for slow roll, we have these two conditions, we need eta, much, much less than one, and also epsilon, much, much less than one. Okay, and so again, all this says is that the slope of the potential and the curvature of the potential both must be small in Planck units. Okay. Good, okay, so then the last thing let's do is to go through a simple example of applying this. Okay, So let's go through the simplest inflationary model, which is called chaotic inflation. Okay, so let's suppose that this V of phi is some power law. Okay, so let's say that V is like phi to the n with some normalization out front, okay? Yeah. And so examples of this include like, you know, m squared phi squared, lambda phi to the fourth, et cetera, okay? You know, for some general n, okay? Good, so now let's work out these slow roll parameters for this example, okay? So maybe I'll let you guys work this out. So, for this V, what is V prime? Mm-hmm. Which is, I can write that as, phi n phi n minus 1, which is just n V over phi. Okay, similarly, what is V double prime? Okay, good. So then what are epsilon and eta?
Epsilon is squared. Half of n and Planck squared.
Say it again.
N times n Planck over phi squared.
Okay, good. And then eta, we get Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so, good. So then now, can we get epsilon and eta small compared to one? For some choice of n. Okay, so for example, let's say n equals 2 for like m squared to phi squared. Yeah, exactly. Okay, right. So therefore, to get epsilon eta small compared to one, we need that phi is large in Planck units. I don't know, like 5 or 10 or something m Planck. Okay, good. So therefore, you can get the slow roll conditions being satisfied as long as phi is large in Planck units. So if we plot this function, okay, v of phi versus phi, okay, so for example, so for like m squared phi squared, it's like some parabola, and we're saying that to have slow roll being satisfied, phi has to be large in Planck units, starting somewhere like way out here. Okay, so now intuitively, okay, right, like so intuitively we had said that for slow roll to happen, the slope has to be really small, right? But if I start like way out here, the slope looks rather steep, doesn't it? Okay, so then why is it then that being way out here still satisfies slow roll conditions? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
No, I feel like I'm wrong. I don't know, I was saying maybe it's not, we're not looking at exactly the slope, we're looking at like the slope compared to
U. Right. Epsilon was?
Yeah, compared to V.
Compared to V.
V is large.
Right, okay. And now the physical interpretation of this is that, yeah, so out here, V prime is very large, okay? But because V is so large, the friction is also really large. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so the friction being so large out here stops the field from just barreling down this potential. Okay, good. And then the last thing we'll do before we quit then is to answer your question about how many E folds we get starting from some phi. Okay, so let's work that out. So the number of e-folds we get, okay, is just the change in log A going from the start to the end of inflation, right? Okay, so this change in log A, I can write as the integral of d log A dt dt. Okay, but d log a dt is a dot over a, which is h. So h dt from the start to the end. Okay, I can write this as integral of h, and now I can write dt as d phi over phi dot. Okay, so now let's use, do I still have it? Yes, I still have that 3h phi dot is approximately equal to minus v prime. Okay, so good. So now we'll replace the phi dot with the v prime. So this is approximately integral of h squared with a 3, I think, over v prime d phi. Okay, and then I'll use the Friedmann equation. So 3h squared is 8 pi g rho, which is 8 pi g v. Okay, so, and 8 pi g, I'll write as 1 over Planck mass squared. Integral of v over v prime d phi. Okay, so good. So now for our example of this chaotic inflation where v is, say, phi to the n, v over v prime is what? Okay, so now v over v prime will give me phi over n. I guess there's the n out front. Okay, going from the start of inflation to the end. Okay, the starting, right. So therefore this is just 1 half phi squared, right? So this is approximately 1 half phi start over m Planck squared minus phi end over m Planck squared, but again, phi start is much larger than phi end. Okay? So therefore, to get many e-folds, what do we need? the field has to roll a large amount compared to M Planck. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So you can get inflation even from these very simple potentials. So this is just the simplest example you can write down. More commonly, you'll see more like you know things more like effective potentials with like shapes like shapes like this or whatever. Okay. Right. You know. I mean. Anyway. Yeah. So there's lots of constructions you can write down that can successfully drive inflation. Yeah.
So right now, I've never heard of any way to like pick out some potential that's not sort of like a fine-tuned thing. Is there any way around it?
Well, so here did I fine-tune?
Here you didn't fine-tune, but
I just said that we have to start far enough away from the far enough away from the bottom, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. But if you say wanted to model things like, you know, like how do you know it's not exponential? How do you know it's not, you know, like e to the phi or something? How do you know it's not? There's a bunch of things you can try out, and like there's so many models. How do you?
There are lots of models. Okay, so the fine tuning comes really from trying to make these models, you know, these models for inflation consistent with what we see. Uh-huh. So and the main constraint on that will be the perturbations. Okay. Right. So since we only have like 1 day left, basically, I think we won't have time to get into the tensor perturbations, gravitational wave perturbations from inflation. Right. But the upper limits on that, combined with the scalar perturbations that are seen, that limits the possible shapes of these types of potentials.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And are there more observations that can place additional constraints?
Oh, there's so many. So what we have seen so far on the sky is the scalar perturbations. We have upper limits on these gravitational wave perturbations. Probably the most exciting way to probe the physics, the physics of inflation, is to look beyond two-point statistics. So that is to look for non-Gaussianities in the perturbations. Okay, so I haven't yet explained about why inflation makes almost Gaussian perturbations, but next time hopefully we'll talk about that. So just the basic idea is that if this V of phi is very flat, okay, this looks like a free field, okay, and so the fluctuations of a free field are like almost Gaussian distributed, right? Okay, so that's the basic reason why inflation generically predicts perturbations that are almost Gaussian distributed. Okay, any deviation from this flat shape corresponds to dynamics. So any form of like interactions of that field will correspond to a potential that isn't quite flat. Okay, and therefore will give you deviations from Gaussian fluctuations. And so the main way that we're hoping to learn about inflation is to look for deviations from Gaussianity, because those deviations tell us about the interactions of these fields back at early times. So people here have worked a lot on this. So Kendrick has done lots of work constraining deviations from Gaussianity using the CMB. So I've done related work on showing how galaxies can be used to look for deviations from from this Gaussianity. Anyway, yeah, so there's like lots of effort devoted to this. Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So the main probes. So the main observational probes for inflation are the scalar perturbations, the power spectrum, which is like the two-point function, but then things like this non-Gaussianity.
Is that like higher like endpoint?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So the way that we look for the deviations from from Gaussianity is so the lowest order thing that we first look for is just like the three-point function. So those are two exciting ways. The other direction that we use is to try and get better and better probes of the tensor perturbations, the gravitational wave perturbations. So it's too bad that we won't have time to talk about that much because the physics of the gravitational wave perturbations from inflation is actually much simpler than the physics of the scalar perturbations from inflation. So since we won't have time, what I'll just mention to you is that the amplitude of the tensor perturbations, it tells you the height of this potential during inflation. Okay, you know, right. So I mean, right. You know, so the amplitude, call it like, I don't know, h squared. Okay, an amplitude. Okay, so the amplitude of this just directly tells you the height of this energy scale during inflation. Okay. Similarly, the amplitude of the scalar perturbation, this is delta squared. Okay, it's also, I mean, right. So this is also related to this height, along with other things like these slow roll parameters that we'll talk about. Okay, so therefore we can't directly use the observed amplitude of scalar perturbations just to read off the energy scale of inflation. Okay, unfortunately, but if we could just, you know, directly detect the, you know, so the gravitational wave perturbations from inflation, that would just directly immediately tell us the energy scale of inflation. Yeah, and that's why like so much work in the CMB is devoted towards trying to detect or constrain gravitational wave backgrounds, you know, us using the CMB. And well, so you're all too young for this, but about 8 years ago, there was a claim detection of, you know, of these inflationary gravitational waves in the CMB. And so for about a month or so, every cosmologist in the world was just like drinking champagne and just like high-fiving each other, and just people were just like so happy. And then like a month or two later, it was shown to be just spurious. but for a while, everyone was just ecstatic because it was like a direct detection of quantum fluctuations, quantum gravity, basically, seen on the sky. Yeah. Anyway. So next time I think we'll just focus on the scalar perturbations because that's what you guys have been computing. But just be aware that, you know, the same quantum fluctuations of the inflation field also generate gravitational wave fluctuations.
Yeah. Six questions.
Okay, so then why don't we end here and then we can talk. Yeah.